see.
Anybody want this chair?
Okay, so I think, are there any comments or questions? And then let's do another practice. This is what I call taking the body for a walk and exploring what it is to operate with more or less sense of self present, including perhaps sometimes not much sense at all. And then we'll come back and talk about that as an experience and also talk about it in terms of the brain. All right? So any comments or questions before we do that practice?
I'm doing some collating, and I'd like to finish it before the wind takes it away, so could you come back for a couple minutes?
All right. It's like a DJ. You don't want to have empty air, right?
I'll be over here making noise.
Oh, that's no problem at all. Okay. So comments, questions?
I do have one.
Yeah.
This spacious awareness that we in our last practice, and one pointed this so very different. How do they relate?
You mean absorption?
Yeah. One point that seems to be sort of the focusing down, down, and then the last practice expanding outwards.
Yeah. Well, that's it's my tagline today. That's a really good question. You know, that's a deep question, because it is actually. And often it's said there are two basic kinds of meditation, and the research on meditation tends to use one of these two paradigms. Either what's called focused attention, right, or open awareness. And in yesterday's workshop, we did a lot of focused attention practices where we were one-pointed on a single object, let's say the breath, although one could use other objects like the sense of singleness, right? Whereas here, this was the quintessential open awareness, Vipassana style, you know, choiceless awareness kind of thing, right? And so they really are different, correct? They feel different, don't they? What does get kind of interesting is that when there is absorption, there still can be a sense that what one is absorbed into is arises in this boundless, limitless space. First off, right? Second, when we're doing open awareness, we are trying to stay stably present with whatever arises. And when we're doing focused attention, we are becoming absorbed into one object. And to me, that's a key difference. And one thing that's hard about open awareness is not getting hijacked by what streams through the mind. Because it's so easy to get hijacked. As to what's happening neurologically, if you will, I'm not entirely sure. I think what partly is happening, can we turn the projector on? I'll show you some slides that'll be relevant for this. It'll set up this little practice we'll do. Thank you, by the way, Ann and Chaz, for rescuing. I got a call at about 8 this morning when I was casually drinking my coffee that said, "We have a slide projector. You want?" Yes, at that point, I went into hyperdrive. They probably went into hyperdrive. And then here we are. So again, thank you very much for doing this.
You worked for a while.
Yeah.
I have a related question.
Yeah.
So, Matthew Ricard?
Yeah.
The slide of
sure.
Him,
good.
At one point, let's see, you said that he was doing that the gamma.
Yeah.
So do you know what type of meditation he was doing?
I think from that study where I got that picture, he was, I believe, doing compassion practice.
Yeah. Was it a visualization?
I'm not sure. I think it was left as pretty vague what he was actually doing. And I mean, I could go back and reconstruct that. But
so I was just wondering if
I think it was boundless compassion. Whatever they do when they do boundless compassion, those Tibetan monks, those guys, that's what he was doing. Boundless compassion, which means non-referential compassion, not in reference to anyone. That's what he was doing. But he could have been focusing on the breath. Any kind of top-down focus, any kind of focused awareness, you're going to light up the interior cingulate until you become so absorbed, like in the second jhana, that applied and sustained attention fall away. In other words, the ACC, actually, let's do it like this, for those of you that were not here. See, this is fast, right? Here we go. There we go. That's Mathieu's brain. That is your brain on mindfulness. That's your brain on meditation. And that little orangey caterpillar area is the anterior frontal cingulate cortex, which is the part of the brain that's involved in the conscious control of attention. So whether you're focused on the breath or bliss or non-referential awareness or marriage with Christ, because the nun's picture right here, you're lighting up that focused attention place. So I think, to go back to Anne's question, when we're really focused, we're really activating the cingulate cortex, you know, very, very strongly.
So that's one with the gamma.
Oh, okay. Gamma waves are, so the brain, so neurons pulse, right? They signal each other. And when they pulse in harmony with each other, that creates little waves of measurable electrical activity. Because when a neuron fires, it sends across, a few neurons send electrical signals across the synapse. They're called gap junction neurons. But most neurons release little surges of neurotransmitter molecules. And those molecules cross this tiny, tiny, tiny. You could get, I think, something on the order of 5,000 synapses in the width of a human hair. It's really tiny. And at the speed of molecular action, you could have the same, a neuron can fire even up to 100 times a second. It'll tend to kill itself if it keeps firing too much. But 50 times a second, certainly 10 times a second, not a big deal. So it releases those little neurotransmitters into what's called the synaptic cleft, that little tiny gap. And then they are molecules like serotonin or dopamine or norepinephrine or oxytocin. You know, the love so-called hormone or neurotransmitter. It's just a molecule. It's called a hormone. When it is active in the outside the nervous system, it's called a neurotransmitter. When it's active inside the nervous system, so estrogen, for example, which men have as well as women, just like women have testosterone, too. Men just have a lot more testosterone than estrogen, and vice versa. But anyway, in the body, it's a hormone. In the brain, it's a neurotransmitter, but it's the same molecule. A little detail, okay? Because sometimes it's confusing when you read about this stuff. All right, so in that little those molecules bloop, burp into. There's a balloon full of them. It gets carried to the sending tip. I visualize the Sistine Chapel, God's finger and Adam coming together. That's a synapse. Okay, when God's finger burps some serotonin molecules, boop, you know, Adam's finger or Eve's finger receives it. That's the synapse right there. Happens really fast. What that does is at any moment in time, remember, a neuron is getting signals from maybe 1,000 neurons upstream. Talk about causal factors. And they're all burping to it simultaneously. And some of them are releasing excitatory neurotransmitters, and some of them are releasing inhibitory ones. In other words, there are green lights and red lights. And the moment-to-moment sum of green light and red light, green lights and red lights, adds up to a go or no-go signal. So if you cross a threshold of green lights compared to red lights, gas pedal versus compared to brakes, that neuron fires. And when it does, it basically opens up these little gates down the long, it's so amazing how this happens actually, down the long line of the axon. So the cell body on the left gets all these go, no go signals, crosses a threshold to go. In other words, it changes enough of the electrochemistry inside the cell body. because when it releases when it receives these neurotransmitters from upstream, those open little gates locally, and ions that surround the neuron can rush in, or some of which are positive, some of which are negative, depending on the gate. So the moment-to-moment summation of that, if it goes above a threshold, or actually drops below a threshold technically, then at that point a big gate opens at the entry into the long axon, which is like a wire connecting this cell body to other cell bodies. You kind of get that basically? And then a cascade ripples down the axon and then hits its tip, and when it hits its axon terminal button, it pops open the gate that releases neurotransmitters into the synaptic cleft for other neurons downstream. Your understanding of what I'm saying right now in the last minute or two, for better or worse, is achieved through quadrillions of synaptic events in the last 2 or 3 minutes inside your brain. Wow. And we didn't earn any of it. It's just our gift from evolution. Thank you. Trazillions of creatures who lived and died in part, so slowly accumulating benefits, could congeal as us today. Thank you. Right? Like, wow. Gratitude right there. So, okay. So, in terms of what in the world I was talking about with the attention regions and gamma waves. So we have these little neurons connecting to each other, and when they fire, there's a little electrical activity. If you get a lot of them doing it in rhythm with each other, so you have a lot of peaks and valleys, peaks and valleys, peaks and valleys. Well, what's a lot of peaks and valleys? It's a wave, right? And if the peaks and valleys are sort of separated, like they occur maybe once a second, that's a really slow wave. But if they occur 5 times a second, that's 5 times a second. The term is hertz. Hertz means number of times per second. That's all it means. So 5 hertz is 5 times per second, a fifth of a second between the beats. 30 hertz is the territory of gamma waves. They're just called gamma waves. Gamma waves mean fast. The interesting thing about fast waves is that it requires a lot of synchrony. In other words, you can kind of be sloppy in the beat if it's just once or 5 times a second, because that's slow-mo. That's like a Viennese waltz for neurons. 5 times a second, that's like Quaaludes time, you know? Whereas 30 times a second, man, you got to be on your number. You got to have that bop, 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 bop. You got to be really good. So fast waves tend to synchronize large populations of neurons in the brain. Gives us that unification of awareness, that integration. And also, when you're getting a lot of pulsings, you're getting a lot of firings, and therefore you're getting a lot of wirings. So gamma activity promotes learning. See? So if we're in, hypothetically, a very meditative state that's emotionally positive, has some kind of beautiful sort of awareness insight about the way it all is, and that's related to fast gamma wave activity, we're training large swaths of the brain, and we're training them fast. We're training them well to really absorb that learning. And the interesting thing is that people who meditate a lot have higher resting state gamma activity, even when they're not doing a mindfulness practice. Their brains do change over time. So that was what that was.
And I didn't know if there was a specific mindfulness practice that would have those gamma waves, for example, because of the, focus attention one or the open space.
I think that's, a very interesting question. First, if attention is stable, if there's stability, whether it's stability in a single object or stability as a stable sati, stable knowing, there's stability either way. Mm-hmm. I think if you get a lot of stability, you're getting a lot of gamma, because how else do you integrate and cohere all these different neural coalitions, they're called, or assemblies? The other thing is that I suspect, and this goes to, if we could make that thing go, or it's too hot. It's overheated? That's okay.
Try changing the slide. Maybe it's a screensaver. No.
No worries. I'll cue up something, and we can turn it off, and I'll come back to it, and then we'll do this practice.
If we use this fan over there, Chaz, would that help?
No, well, I don't. It's not that. I don't know what's wrong with it. It's been on the fridge.
Yeah,
for
no worries.
I can't even turn it off. I have to pull the plug.
So let's see here. I want to draw your attention to two things, and you have it in your handout. So the first, following our Lord of the Rings analogy, on page, let's see, it's the page, so we find the page that starts with the opening slide, no self in the brain.
So people that have numbers, that's page.
It's the page just before that page. It's, yeah, the SAM page.
SAM page is 14.
All right, you're on 14.
Numbers. And for those of you who are on page 2, it starts at the top. SAM sees keeping among the. Oh, here's a quote at the top.
Yeah. Okay? So, I like that quote a lot because it really gets at, it gets at bodhicitta, you know, true nature, Buddha nature. It's just that even if the eddies in the stream are really yucko, even if toxic chemicals and waste are floating down the stream, what's in the stream is, the stream itself is nonetheless pure. An analogy I like for that is that if you bought a house that had been closed up for many, many years and you wanted to, you know, use the water, if you turn on the spigot, the faucet, what might initially come out is smelly green and brown and yucky. And the tendency might be initially to tighten it down again. Yuck. But what we have to do is let it run. Right? Sometimes that's what we have to do with negative states of mind. We have to let them release. And then after a while, the water is pure, is clean. But the really interesting thing is that all along, not one single molecule of water was sullied. Right? Awareness, hell holds contents, but is not itself sullied or tainted. Water itself, holding those yucky contents coming out through the faucet after all those years, is not itself sullied or tainted. You know, our true nature, Buddha nature, it cannot be, is never sullied or tainted or damaged or harmed or poisoned by whatever it carries through. That, I like that analogy myself, that water itself is always pure. Okay, so I just wanted to share with you this quote. It's one of my favorite quotes. If you recall, you may know that Sam thinks this. He's Frodo's friend. They're carrying the Ring of Power to the top of Mount Doom to, you know, win or lose on a single throw, you know, change the course of history, and they do make it, but on the way there, they're just at the very, very end. Sam's full of despair, and he has this insight based on seeing a cloud, a star, through the clouds of the evil master Sauron, that no matter how many clouds Sauron created, the stars are always still there. You know, no matter how much true nature is obscured, it's still always there. Just want to say that. And then I want to draw your attention to I think I will actually not do that right now. I think what we should do is a practice. Okay? And so, actually, I'll say this, Anne, to complete my response to your question. I suspect that when we're doing stable, open awareness, we are actually expanding the neural substrate of the global workspace of consciousness. Because if we're just absorbed in one thing, the sensations of the breath, perhaps, or bliss, or the sense of singleness, if we're just absorbed in one thing, you don't need that much neural substrate to be aware of that one thing. If anything, part of what you're trying to do when you're doing absorption is you're really trying to quiet and relatively deactivate neural noise. You know, you're trying to get so absorbed in the signal and have all the noise around it drop out of the one thing. On the other hand, when you're aware, open space awareness, if it's really stable, that's a lot of space, particularly when you expand it out wider and wider and wider. So I think that kind of practice, from a neurological standpoint, is uniquely valuable because you really are training large swaths of neural real estate to synchronize and harmonize and integrate with each other in a stable way as you go through life. Does it make, follow me? So You see what I mean? You're literally you're kind of expanding it out. And actually, to make this point, which is about consciousness, one of the theories about what is consciousness, what is awareness, is that it can be defined as the degree to which a system can hold a variety of information and integrate it. So, what's interesting is that there's been research on different physical systems. And what are the different physical systems that can hold more possibilities of information? And then there's a mathematical calculation that basically says, ultimately, how conscious those physical systems can be. So, okay? And what's interesting is that a physical system, and in your, I think it's in your handout, the reference for the slide where it's about anesthesia is one of the key people that's doing this kind of thing, and you can look it up. But the point is that the more connections there are in a system, and the more it's networked around hubs, so you have hubs with intense spokes to other hubs, okay, the more conscious the system can be. In other words, the more that we train the brain to have a larger and larger neural substrate of awareness, truly, literally, the more conscious we become. That's the punchline. So that literally as we train our brains through practices to be more stably, spaciously mindful of a large field, and we stabilize that, you know, volatile neural assembly, and it gets more and more stable, stays, we are training through firing, we're wiring, we're training the neural substrate of literally more consciousness. We are more conscious. In other words, consciousness is not just either or this kind of thing, like white. You can't be more or less white. You know, there's white. I don't mean that racially. I just mean as a color. There's red. It is red. Well, maybe there can be more consciousness and supported by a change in the hardware that supports it, which kind of corresponds to our experience, doesn't it? We feel through practice that we've become more conscious. We're aware of more things, there's more integration, there's more here and now, present time awareness. We probably really are more conscious. You know, when we're around beings who are really evolved, we just talk about them. Whoa, so conscious. You know, just empty space, consciousness there. We really feel it. We feel almost like increasingly there's this increasingly transparent window for consciousness to be apprehended. Who knows, maybe transcendental consciousness shining through. There's just more consciousness. Makes me think that that actually corresponds to something that's truly changed in the brain on the path of practice.
But then if you have a practice that concentrates on concentration, if you will, are you missing out on that kind of overall, what do you call it, the
large open space?
Yeah, that substrate. Overall development, substrate of consciousness. And if so, if you have a practice that's mostly concentration, then maybe it would behoove you to bring in more of the spatial practice.
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, of course, this is, I want to offer a lot of, really this tentatively and don't know, a lot of limitations and hedges, you know, informed speculation, but I think that's true, and I also think that's traditional advice. In other words, I think traditional advice that works, and it did work without knowing anything about this neuro stuff, it has worked. Often they find what works because it works because the mind rests in the brain. So they've learned these things. It is also interesting that after we do the four form jhanas, even equanimity, the fourth jhana, you know, here is a very spacious state of awareness.
And then you get the formless.
Exactly where I'm going. Exactly where I'm going. It's not, to me, a surprise that the formless ones are called out after the form jhanas. And they are way wide open, you know. I'm going to do a thing after this practice where I'm going to talk about what I call dual mode theory and how the practice of stable shikantaza, just sitting, just choiceless awareness, particularly as we stabilize in it, I think is a very, very, very powerful practice. You know, and why, and I'll talk with you about why I think that is, and some of the implications of it, and also some of, once you understand what it could be in the brain, you start thinking about ways to support those wholesome brain states. So we'll see. Okay? All right? Again, we want it as much as we can. This is very cool stuff to intellectualize about. But we want to keep bringing it down to, what difference does this make to me? You know, how can I use this today? Or how might this help me tweak or fine-tune my own personal practice right now? Okay? So, so now we'll do a practice. And in this practice, I invite you to be really aware of selfing. And I'll use the gerund form, selfing. Be aware of I, me, and mine. In a sense, I I'll say it like this. If you think about greed, hatred, and delusion, it's interesting that mine is the act of greed, right? Me, particularly given our threat sensitivity as animals who evolved, me is very much the basis of hatred, broadly defined, aversion. And I carries with it a fundamental kind of delusion. So it's interesting to make that correspondence, you know, right? Mine, me, and I. And so, as you can, just watch I, me, and mine arise and disperse in the open space of awareness. And as best you can, encourage them to leave town. Encourage those clouds to disperse. Encourage those birds to fly away. You know, encourage those eddies to, you know, settle back into the stream that they're just a momentary modification of. All right? And then we'll come back and talk about it. So, when I say you in this exercise, I mean the person you are, not a self. Right? So, just so you know that. That's what I mean by that. Try to take you in a very loose sense as this body-mind, which has a personal history and a set of associations, but doesn't necessarily have, you know, a self in the way we normally mean that. Okay, so let's try it. So if you could, take a moment to come into your body. And establish the intention to let go. To let go of selfing. Not out of aversion, but out of kindness to the person you are. Resting in awareness of breathing. Continually letting go. Letting go of I, me and mine, with every exhalation. letting go of any sense of I controlling my breathing. Letting the body breathe on its own, selflessly. Awareness is here. Objects of awareness are here. Does there need to be an I for awareness and its objects to be here? Observing that the sense of self comes and goes like any other mind object. Increasing and decreasing like any other mind object. And different aspects of self, personal memories, personal wishes, commentary in the mind. Rising and falling, coming and going, and noticing the fact that much of the time there's actually little sense of a personal I. Now, if you like, you can experiment with gently opening your eyes to explore vision occurring without needing an eye present to receive it. Perhaps move your gaze around gently, experimenting with the objects of your gaze needing no self to receive them. And if you like, experiment with small movements without a sense of I needing to make them happen or be the subject of what they feel like. Perhaps a finger moving a little or a shoulder shrugging slightly, the head turning. There may be intentions or directions prompting these movements, but without needing an I to guide them. And now, if you like, experiment with gently standing up without needing I to guide the standing. Maybe do it quite slowly to see what that's like, to stand without needing I to choose it or guide it. Notice how I often comes in after the fact and claims actions as its own. Like a child chasing after a parade, see what I created. But actually, I does not know how to make the knees bend. Or the legs thrust. Explore standing here with as little sense of self as possible. Standing in place, explore moving a little. In that space, awareness of movement happening without needing an owner. And then, as you like, in a moment, you can explore walking or moving about for 5 minutes in this room or outside without needing a self. Not making eye contact, but moving, exploring, seeing, hearing, touching, perhaps tasting, without needing to identify with experiences or own them. We'll do this for 5 minutes in silence, and then I'll ring the bell and we'll come back. So as you like, explore movement and action, slow or fast, in or out, with as little sense of self as possible.